everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing in life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. That's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. We're funded by the good people at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, go to pnwa.org. And PNWA has a yearly writers' conference, and at that conference, there is a contest, a writing contest for unpublished works. And today's guest, Donna Conrad, her novel last year won Best Historical Novel in that contest. It's a published book now, yeah. And there's a couple of reasons you might find my conversation with Donna, my second, inspiring. Not only did she enter that contest and win, but this book, The Last Magdalene, which is her first, I think it's her first novel. I interviewed her when she wrote a memoir about the 60s a few years ago. But this book, The Last Magdalene, like a few other people I've known, took a long time to get done. She said it came to her first in 2001, the first sentence of it. It took her this long to find it and publish it. And by the way, in this interview, at one point I'm struggling to remember the name of an author I just interviewed, Rhode Island Memoirs, Carla Pansiera. Sorry, Carla. Yes, that was the author I was trying to remember. Anyway, yes, Donna took a long time to publish her book, but publish it she did. I should say that she is, she is an award-winning author, journalist, activist, and teacher. She's a regular presenter at writers' conferences, and her first published book, as I mentioned, was a memoir called House of the Moon, Surviving the 60s. But The Last Magdalene, which chronicles, the life in part. Well, I'm not going to give it away. Mary Magdalene, obviously, but she goes into all kinds of stuff. So we had a fascinating conversation about writing, about finding the voice of the book, finding the form, what it took for the vulnerability required for her to tell this story. Oh, really interesting stuff. Donna's a very cool person, and I'm glad I get to share this conversation with you now. Enjoy. All right. Okay, it's back on the show. It's none other than Donna Conrad. Donna D. Conrad. Donna, how are you doing?
I am doing great. And yourself?
I'm splendid. So this is a long time coming, this particular conversation, I think. Before we dive into it, listeners of the show may remember you from a bunch of years back when we talked about House of the Moon, your memoir about your crazy life in the 60s. That was a few years ago. But now you have gone in a totally different direction from memoir to fiction, historical fiction, and a subject near and dear to many people. So that's quite a journey. So the book, The Last Magdalene, is coming out in, would you say April 4th?
9th.
9th, okay.
April 9th.
How are you? So as I record this, that's about a month away. How are you feeling? How are you feeling about it?
I am actually a bit stunned by the incredible response it's getting.
Yeah.
As you say, it's a difficult subject, a touchy subject, and yet it seems all the reviewers, all the beta readers, everybody is really getting what is at the heart of this story, which is to finally hear from a woman who was there and what life was like at this pivotal time of history. I mean, this changed the Western world, but a lot of people say the entire world. And to be at the heart of it and to tell her story. And that's been so gratifying to me that people get that part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking of Alice Hoffman wrote a book set in the same time and place, also from a point of view of a woman that was, I can't remember the name of it.
The Dove Keepers.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
Love so
it's a subject that has not gotten a lot of attention, but I'm glad you have given it yours. So I have to say, because I'm fascinated by your decision to do this, but I'm telling you, I remember talking to you about this book
a while ago. I think
Oh, yeah.
we were at the conference, and I think you were talking to Donald Moss. So this is, and that was a few year, more than a few years ago. And so this has been one that you've been kicking around for a long time, yeah?
So, confessional time, the opening line of the book, which I'll give away, I have heard tales of my madness. This is first person from the Magdalene's point of view. I wrote that in 2001.
Did you know it was about this subject when you wrote it?
I had gotten back from France. I met a Magdalene scholar who had read one of my previous books and said, "You need to write about this woman." And I said, "Yeah, who is she?" She said, "Let me take you to France." So we went to France. We went to all the sites. I climbed to the top of some bomb, did all of it, and came back. And again, you know, those flashes of insights that happen at 2 in the morning. I woke up and I really heard this voice that said, "I have heard tales of my madness."
You when you hear
And
that, you just have
that kind of voice, you go, "Okay, I'm paying attention."
yeah. So, and I wanted to bring it up because I know a bunch of our listeners are writers themselves, and who did I just talk to about this? No, shoot, the memoirist. I'm blanking. I just interviewed the Rhode Island memoirist, whose memoir took her 30 years to publish. And I mean, off and on, we were talking about Carl Marlantes, who wrote Matterhorn. It took him 30 years to write that too. And so I mention it because sometimes books come to us, and man, does it take a while for us to figure out how to write them. And this was, and talking to you, when I talked to you about this, when you first talked to me about it at the PNWA, you were in the like, what you were in that still that wrestling match with it that so many novelists go through. Well, not just novelists, but you were like, what is it? How do I get it? What's the form? And this would probably would have been 8 or 9 years ago. So when did you like, so you were working on it then, even though you had House of the Moon was probably in the works or
It
selling or,
was coming. It was coming out. And how I switched from the one, I'm passionate about telling women's stories that have been marginalized. And I was wrestling with The Last Magdalene that was called something completely else. So writers, you're not going to know the title until the book's finished. You're just not. And yeah, you know that one. And I was really struggling with it. And I started thinking about my life and that in the 60s, I was a woman that was marginalized. I didn't have a voice. And so I thought, okay, tell your story and you'll teach yourself how to write real, how to write raw,
Oh,
how to
that
put
was
it
the.
all out on the page. That was what turned the Magdalene around.
That's fascinating. So you had to say, I got to tell my story honestly and a way to get in touch
Before
with,
I.
right, to really get in touch with what does it mean to be marginalized? Because here's the thing, I'm going to push back a little bit on the marginalization, just a bit. But from a loving place, which is on some level, we all marginalize ourselves. On some level, we all
Absolutely.
silence ourselves. I'm not saying society doesn't have its role, but we have to be complicit. We have to capitulate, or it doesn't happen, you know, because there's plenty of people who stood up and said, to hell with it, I'm going to speak. And so in writing, you have to learn your own role in it. Is that fair to say? Like, why did I keep
Absolutely.
silent? Why didn't I say something? What was the deal? Right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of what drove me to be a writer was to have a voice. And I think I'm generalizing, but I think most writers, that's what they do. I have something I want to say, and I want to say it in my way. And so that's what House of the Moon was. It was me being as brutally honest as I could about my life, about my choices, about the society in which has been kind of glamorized and wasn't quite so glamorous. And in doing that, I would say without House of the Moon, none of my other books. I have a 4-book deal for The Last Magdalene. It's going to be, there are 3 more
Great.
books coming.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It would not be making the impact it made unless I learned to write fearlessly to give
Thank
you
you,
credit the
Court.
way
There you
that made.
go. That's good.
And it, you one has to, as a writer, I feel, just set aside the ego, set aside what you think you're supposed to write and how the story is supposed to go, and just allow yourself to be vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had you learned that with House of the Moon. So that's when you came back to Last Magdalen, you were able to be, you were able to approach it with that humility, that vulnerability to let yourself tell that story.
Exactly. And to let her tell her story in a way that I had all the historical facts. I knew all about the time. I knew all about the places. I knew what they ate and how they felt and this and that and everything else. But to get to her reactions to life at that time, to what was going on, to what her role was, to what she lost, to what she still had to gain. And, you know, there is a part of the book where she has to make that choice. Am I going to live my life? And I'm going to do it in this way. But in between House of the Moon and the final versions of The Last Magdalen are two very important mentors I had. And one is Jack White.
Yeah. Yeah. Passed
who
away
read when, like
recently,
2021,
right?
2021. Yeah. He knew this book had gone, he knew the deal had gone forward. I'm just sorry you're not here, but the book is dedicated to him.
That's great.
And he read a very brutal scene in the book and took me aside after the masterclass and said, "You're being very honest, but you're not being open."
Oh, interesting.
And I went, okay. So we talked, but he became a real mentor and he walked me through changing the book. I mean, just digging deeper. And the other is somebody we all know, Donald Moss.
Oh, Don helped you through it?
Oh God, I say in the acknowledgments that if your heart breaks at any point, that's due to Donald Moss. Because he worked with me and he was sending me emails. And this one time he was going on and on and on about what he wanted. And finally I said, "Don, I'm not getting it. What do you want?" And he wrote me back, "Break my heart."
Very good.
And that changed the way I approached it. Because for writers, to break somebody else's heart, I feel you break your own.
Sure.
You have to go to that place.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say heartbreak is interesting. I mean, it's a place I've written about it recently. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the way I don't tend to focus on it in my work anymore, but I do think that for many of us, that is the time we feel most alive, weirdly. Now, I don't think you can feel just as alive when you with a full heart. Let us not forget. But there is something about that heartbreak. And I've had those moments in my life where you suddenly, it just gets your attention and it's like, ha. Life matters here.
Yes.
Wake up. And so good for you. And good for Don. Good for Don. Those of you who don't, Donald Moss, writing the breakout book.
Breaking Your Heart.
Literary agent, wonderful guy, good teacher, and a fairly regular visitor to the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference. And speaking of which, I just have to tell this story for our listeners. I believe I, sitting next to C.C. Humphreys, was the one that told you via text that because you were off gallivanting, I don't know where, that
Spain.
You had won. You were in Spain.
Yes.
And I told you it won. I think it came from me, did it not?
It did. You were the first. You were the first. Chris had agreed to go up. And it was so funny because I can't tell you who's going to win.
No.
But somebody at PNWA, I said, I can't be there. And somebody kept writing saying, well, it'd be good if somebody was.
You had somebody you could at least place or something. You didn't know.
I knew I had placed or something. So I asked Chris.
What's it called? The Nancy Pearl or the other?
No. The book's going to be entered in the Nancy Pearl. Yeah, this hadn't been.
Okay.
So it's going back in for Nancy Pearl now. We'll see how it does. But this was historical fiction.
All right. So wait, just quickly for our listeners. For our listeners who don't know, what we're gabbing here about is the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference. I've mentioned it probably on this podcast. It's a conference we have every year, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association throws, and there's a contest. And there's two contests, one for unpublished works, and there's a huge variety of genres, and one for published works called the Nancy Pearl Award. And Donna won for what was the category? Was it historical?
Historical fiction.
Won first prize in historical fiction. It does not surprise me. And I was sitting at the table when I was sitting there listening to her name be called. I was so happy. I went and text messaged her. You won, Donna. So that's what we're talking about. So congratulations.
I was actually getting on the plane. We were all seated, headed to Spain, and my phone beeped, and I looked at it, and it was your message, and I just went,
the plane's
looking at me. No, I'm not having a meltdown. And I told everybody I had just won a really prestigious writer's conference. So to everybody listening, enter the contest.
Yeah, it can help. It can. But you already had a book deal with this by then, or did you not?
I did.
Okay.
Well, it was kind of up in the air. It was like, yeah, sure, we're trying this when I entered the contest.
Mm.
So, but then it got solidified. But again, it's not coming out until April.
Right.
But
so,
yeah, it.
So you dealt with it. So a subject matter, The Last Magdalene, obviously refers to what we normally call Mary Magdalene, friend of the one and only. And I mentioned because, I mean, that's a subject, obviously, that has been well-traveled. And I think that it takes a courage to approach a subject that is so told over and over and over again, but from a different perspective, not just from a woman's perspective, but also from a more kind of gritty historical, I'm treating it more like historical fiction than myth, you know, which is really where it's been relegated to. And so it did take some courage, I think, well-traveled roads that you're trying to allow us to see fresh, right? Help us see the story.
Correct.
We all have that story. I mean, most of us, and probably a lot of your readers are interested, may even be believers in their own way. So talk to me about the decision. Like, did you have any trepidation about the subject matter?
Off and on.
Yeah.
Yes, off and on. And I approached it, though, what you said about the mythology that surrounds her and the whole beginings of Christianity, what I wanted to do was demythify all the people involved.
Right.
These were, contrary to some church beliefs, these were flesh and blood people. They walked the streets. They put up with Roman occupation. They put up with being told, you can no longer have your customs. You can no longer do what you want to do. You're going to do it our way. And how did that affect them? And it is based mostly on historical facts that can be determined, and also archaeological finds. Which is where, for everybody, this isn't going to be a spoiler alert, but goddess worship still existed.
Right.
According to archaeological finds during the Second Temple period in Jerusalem. So that is always just glossed over. It's not mentioned.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we forget that when, Christianity, when Christ was born, there wasn't a Christianity. There was this little religion that some people were following.
Yeah.
But most of the Roman Empire was pantheon of gods, and goddesses. And so there would have been people worshiping all kinds of stuff. There was a wide variety. There was no one true God, that anyone was talking about except for the Jews. And so at least that's what the limited amount I know. So it does not surprise me that it was still going on because people were believing we were deciding what we wanted to. There was all kinds of options open to folks.
Well, there were, and even in the Hebrew homeland, which spanned, from Galilee in the north to Capreus, all these areas down through Judea, it was a divided kingdom. And the last time the kingdom had been united was under Solomon, King Solomon. And then after he died, it got all broken up and there were two separate entities.
Right.
There was Judea and Israel. And so there was prophecy that a Messiah would come and reunite the kingdoms and reestablish 1,000 years golden reign, in line with Solomon. Well, somehow in like the Middle Ages, the term Messiah took on a spiritual connotation.
Right.
Whereas
in
that time, I mean, in Hebrew, it means the anointed one. It's a king.
Right. Yeah.
So I went back to a time when what the people needed was a king to overthrow Rome and reestablish a country, a nation that was based on Mosaic law.
Right.
And within that, though, was still the, how do I say this, the proscriptions throughout all of the Old Testament against worshiping Ashara.
Ashara being a goddess.
The goddess.
Now they,
as we all know.
Sorry, okay, we're done with that. It's time to move on.
Why do you keep telling somebody not to do something if they're not doing it?
Right.
That was my
how
kind of wormhole into
yeah.
it. You know, as a father, you don't tell your kid not to do something they're not doing because they might get the idea to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we do it anyway, don't we?
I think so. So it's a matter of the prescriptions against it. And why did they persist? And then why do we have small statues of a female deity that have thumb holes grooved into it from women? Pressing and pressing.
Right.
And in my book, I say something that I think is very logical. It says, when babes are hard to bore, it's a priestess women call, not a priest.
Right, right, sure.
And,
makes sense.
And so it the goddess worship, I think, was clandestine, kind of don't ask, don't tell.
Right. That would make sense.
But it existed because to me, any time, if you think of it now in the Christian tradition, women have women saints to go to. They have Jesus's mother to go to.
Yeah.
They have Mary
yeah.
Magdalene to
yeah.
go to.
Yeah.
They would at all times. So to me, that was an important part of writing the book. And that's going to be a controversial part, I think, for some people.
Sure, but what are you going to do? You know, without a little controversy, you know? Well, it's fascinating. I read a history of, it was a book someone gave me called The History of God, and they were talking.
Oh, I love that book.
Yeah, it was fascinating because it pointed out that, like, in the Bible, God went from something you could literally be wrestled with in the Old Testament to a burning bush to just a sort of concept, you know, that's in your heart. So it goes from purely physical to something that doesn't, you will never see, touch, taste, or smell. And so it's fascinating to see the evolution of thought around what the Messiah is, as we change and grow. Even the concept of because it seems like the concept of goddesses is something I have heard a not fair amount about over the last 20 years, that there's been a renewed interest in the concept of one. Of goddess worship,
or of many, you could say.
Many, yeah, sure. Well, and also of sort of the more of some like Wiccan stuff, which kind of in that camp, and it seems to me a natural evolution around feminism. So when you were introduced to the concept of the Magdalens, actually, why don't you explain because, you know, to me, when I heard of Mary Magdalene, that was just her last name. And, you know, that's all I knew of Mary Magdalene. You know, I wasn't a churchgoer, so there was that. But also I knew the name. But your understanding of it is something, it's more of like a title than a last name.
Correct. Correct. And a good example or a comparison of that is, for a long time, we were all brought up on King Arthur.
Right.
And Merlin was the magician. He was the druid.
Yes.
And that was his name. But through archaeological and through historical references, Merlin was the title. That was the chief druid. The chief druid who served Arthur was Taliesin. That was his real name. But he assumed the mantle of Merlin. And there were Merlins before him. And there was,
you know, I didn't know that.
One after him. So he wasn't the last Merlin, but so this is controversial even historically, but the town of Magdala did not exist by that name at this time. So to say someone came from a town that didn't exist, it was called Tresea, and it was later named. So Magda in Hebrew means exalted or high or honored. And so if you're a Magdalene, You are a highly honored, to me, high priestess.
Okay.
And there were priestesses, and it comes down to us today too. Look at all the Marys.
Sure.
In the New Testament. Look at
yeah.
all, you know, it all starts from Miriam, who was Moshe or Moses' sister, who helped lead the forces. She was a warrior,
mm-hmm.
and she led the troops across. She was in there with Aaron and Moses too. Now,
yeah.
if you're going to have a group of priestesses, just kind of like Mary in the Catholic Church now, all the nuns that all take Mary something or
yeah.
other, you're going to name women who are training to honor the divine feminine. They're going to take that name.
Okay.
So that's my contention.
We're getting a little history lesson there, people. We're getting a little history lesson if you want it. If you want it. And so, all right, you had to marry all this history, but you had to tell a story, Donna.
Mm-hmm.
You had to tell a story. And what was the hardest part for you? Was it the story? Finding the story? What the shape the story took? Or was it just what you talked about, learning to get vulnerable and let your heart be broken?
I think it was the vulnerability part. So I know a
yeah.
lot of writers have told you this before. The characters start telling you stories.
Sure, sure. Sure.
And so once I opened up and I had all the history and I set it aside, I let Miriam tell the story, but also other people like Naomi, who's a supposedly fictional character, and is the Magdalene's handmaiden. They all started telling me the story and what life was like. And so I got the basis of the story. The hard part was making it real.
Yeah.
Writing so that people today could understand the trials, the tribulations, the joy, the ecstasy, the heartbreak from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, you have to make it feel like it. You really have to. It can't feel like a foreign, distant, mythical place. You've got to feel like you're walking along the dusty road and you can smell the olives and the sea air. I mean, it's got to all feel as real because it wasn't mythical to them. They were just living it, you know?
They were living it. So I think the blending of the historical with the feeling of the time was probably the most difficult.
Yeah,
but
that would be the tough part.
And I would say, again, what Don helped me with, and Jack White also, because Jack always said, say what you mean and mean what you say and get in there and let people know what it was like. So
right.
Jack and Don approached it from different areas, but it was both to the same thing. And that was the hardest part,
yeah.
I would say, is to tell a story that was not only heartbreaking, but had these moments of ecstasy, these
yeah.
moments of understanding, these moments of claiming one's place in history.
Right.
And that happens to several of the characters.
Yeah.
And so again, as a writer, you have to accept those parts of yourself in order to write it. What Henry Miller always said, I think he stole it from somebody else, but he said, all writing is autobiographical.
I agree. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I always said all memoir is fiction and all fiction is memoir.
I knew I got that from someone when we
That
talked.
Was me. but it's really true. I do think on some level, it is all autobiographical on some level,
mm-hmm.
you know? So the first line, I was going to say the first line of the story is what again? It's you've heard of my madness?
No, I have heard tales of my madness.
Okay, so so you heard that line, that sentence,
mm-hmm.
and what's interesting about that? Because I was one thing that caught my attention was the voice of the narrator. It's a very particular voice you use, and it struck me that it all flows out of that one sentence. Like that sentence has a particular tone to it, a particular authority to it, and the whole book reads like that. And so that is almost like you were given the voice, whether you knew it or not, in that sentence.
I was.
And you kind of had to honor that sentence. Like either you roll from that or it just sticks out like an anomaly, but you followed that. Yeah.
I did. And so when I was writing it, I imagined this older woman had been through all of this,
yeah.
and was sitting around a fire in her cave with young women, and finally said, because the end of the prologue says, you know, I have to tell my story because you've been
right.
told only lies about me. So everything I wrote came from that incredibly wise woman who had lived a life that was fuller than most lives could possibly be. And I told it from that perspective. And even when she was a little girl, there's a voiceover that realizes what's going on and how ridiculous it all was. And you know, the way she behaved and the way things unfolded and how she came to terms with it. So thank you. Yes, that is the voice.
Yeah, no, very clearly. And so, okay, so you heard that voice in 2001. Here it is, 23 years later, and the book will be coming out in a month. I know I asked you this at the beginning, but like, do you have any sense of peace around having finished it to your satisfaction and letting it go out into the world? Like, how do you feel about all that?
It is remarkable. Yeah. I don't know. It's it goes all the way from, oh my God, I'm so glad this is over.
Yeah.
If I have to do one more edit on this book, I'm just going to murder.
Right.
You know that. To being incredibly proud of myself for finishing it and giving myself kudos.
Yeah,
for
you got to do it.
Good. Of it.
Good.
For the
Good.
Writing of it, to say, you've done good.
Yeah.
You held, and one of my pride points is what you said. I held her voice throughout all of it.
Yeah. Well, you should be proud.
Thank you.
You should be proud.
And not, this is not just saying thank you, Bill, but you know, you and I had private sessions with, you know, Writing Fearless, and I listened to your podcast, and I will say, if I hadn't heard that term, fearless writing, I that sunk in.
Oh,
and
good.
So when I sat down to write, it was like, be fearless, put it out there, go. And but fearless to me also means not particularly caring what other people are going to think about you, right? It's being, this is what I have to tell. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. And that means a lot. And I often think that the true root of fearlessness is understanding that you can't be harmed. That actually you are involved, that you can't be hurt really by anything, really. Not really. That there's something in, that you are at core invulnerable to the arrows of opinion. Opinion, really. That's really all. And when it comes to writing, that's about all there is. That's the only real threat, isn't it? I mean, they could rip you off the shelf, I guess, but really, it's just opinion.
Well, and the thing is, this goes right along with my mother, who is Irish. She used to say, in the Celtic tradition, which I was raised in, more than a Christian tradition, she would say that in that tradition, it is your intention, and it is your intention that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
Not how someone else interprets the outcome of that intention. And to me, that goes with the writing. I wrote this with the best intention to be considerate and respectful and tell a story that would ring true for the time. So that was my intention, and I'm fully willing to claim responsibility for that intention.
Own it. Own it.
Own it.
It's good. It's, the book is The Last Magdalene. It will be out April 9th. April 9th, you can pre-order it, people, so it'll just bang, arrive at your door. You won't have to wait. It may even come a little early. Sometimes it does, the magic of Amazon or wherever you order it from. So congratulations again. Long time coming. And I'm glad there's a multi-book deal. So lots more where that came from. Good, 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 good. All good.
Next one will be out in April of 25.
Oh, my God. Look at that.
God is willing and my mind does it.
From
crack.
Nothing to now it's a flood. Okay, good. Good for you. Congratulations. But I'm not done with you. Donna D. Conrad, remember. Right now, see, the answer may have changed now that this book is out. If writing, all the writing you've done, has taught you anything about life and yourself, it's taught you what?
Keep going.
Yes.
Oh, it's good.
It's true, people. It's true. Keep going. I agree. Donna, I'm glad you kept going and you finished this book and you got it out there. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I do hope people enjoy it and look at a different perspective of a woman whose voice still refuses to be silenced.
Yes.
And that's Miriam the Magdalene.
Well, just like all of you listening, don't let your voices be silenced. If Donna's wouldn't, and if Mary's wouldn't, yours shouldn't be either. Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, just keep going, people. Just keep going. It's, God, you know, it's such a cliche and you hear it, but it's true. It's true. Sometimes the simplest advice is the best. Yes, indeed. I want to thank my producer, RJ Jeffries. So good to have you back, my friend. To all of you out there, hey, keep going. Keep going and find something you love to do and go do it.